Most radio shows don't come with a demonstration, but most radio shows aren't Radio Wonderland.
Greatest hits.
Right, so then I take more pieces of live radio, slice them, fit them into the groove, and then in a few minutes you get something like...
Back in LA, some restrictions apply.
It's radio made completely out of radio. I'm Joshua, but you just call me Radio Wonderland.
10:30 a.m. Saturday mornings till 11. Some restrictions
apply. The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that the Riverkeeper activist group is warning not to swim in the Hudson River locally because of the large amount of raw sewage Coxsackie, Hudson, Athens, and Catskill pour into the water. Riverkeeper Director of Advocacy Dan Shapley said, and I quote, "In the Twin Counties, the city of Hudson and Catskill both rely on combined sewers designed to carry only sewage in dry weather. But after rain, that system is designed to overflow into the Hudson River and Catskill Creek. That raw sewage is going into our water," end quote. Riverkeeper, which partners on water monitoring with Queens College and Columbia University's Lamont Doherty's Earth Observatory in routinely testing for fecal indicator bacteria, says that most Greene County and Columbia County tributaries sampled do not meet U.S. Environmental Protection Agency safe swimming criteria. Anyone swimming in Hudson River locally might get bloody diarrhea, abdominal cramps, nausea, vomiting, and fever. Athens Town Supervisor Michael Perrone does not seem worried about all the raw sewage his town is dumping into the Hudson River.
Perrone said, and I quote, "We have very few swimmers. The only thing I would say possibly is that people who go boating park by the flats and go individually swimming. Athens has no beach, no signs that say swimming is permitted. So it's very difficult to say what individual people may do," end quote. Coxsackie Mayor Mark Evans claims, and I quote, "We're not overflowing, or the overflows are very few and far between," end quote. In Catskill, an engineer working on the village's combined sewer overflow elimination project says it will be 5 to 7 years before the problem is solved. And the paper reports, and I quote, "Hudson Mayor Kamal Johnson referred questions on the issue to City Department of Public Works Superintendent Rob Perry, who did not immediately return calls for comment Thursday," end quote. Many cities south of the area use Hudson River water for drinking. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that at the April 17th Greenville Central School District Board of Education meeting, the Greene County Sheriff's Office said they will equip all of its police in local schools with body cameras. The cameras will record video throughout the school day, but will only record audio if the officer presses the button to record. Greene County Sheriff Sergeant Joel Fimmel said anyone filing a Freedom of Information Act could have access to the recordings as they are public records and cannot remain private. Courts ultimately would rule on whether the recordings could be turned over to the requesting member of the public. School will use the recordings for disciplinary actions. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Nick Reisman reports at New York State of Politics that the Democrats that control the legislature and Kathy Hochul still have not agreed on a new budget, though one was due April 1st. Republican Assembly Minority Leader Will Barkley asked, and I quote, "If we're not getting a budget done on time, what else are we not getting done that ought to be done?" end quote. State Senator Tim Kennedy said, and I quote, "We're putting the budget together. We're negotiating. There's a lot to it. It's hundreds of billions of dollars, and we're making sure that at the end of the day, it's the right budget for the people of New York," end quote. But Democrats have had months before April 1st to do all that was needed to be done. Local school districts won't be able to say that. They currently must make budget proposals based on state aid for voters to weigh in on in May 16 elections. But they won't know official funding for schools until the budget is unveiled. Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Group said, and I quote, "It's just another body blow for how people view state government, and at a certain level it increases their cynicism," end quote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 update. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
The gruesome death of LaShawn Thompson in the Fulton County Jail. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. In the early hours of September 13th last year, Officer Gina Andrews approached cell 214 in the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta, Georgia, quote, "To move inmate Thompson for psych evaluation, I noticed inmate Thompson on the floor slumped over, his head was in the toilet, I called his name, and I noticed he was not breathing. And he was not moving," unquote. Thus began inmate incident JA22-3205, describing in cold bureaucratic language the grisly death of 35-year-old LaShawn Pennell Thompson, a black man suffering from mental illness. He'd been jailed for 3 months without charge in pretrial detention because he couldn't afford bail. LaShawn's family didn't know he was there. The incident and autopsy reports they later obtained continue the grim account of his death. Officer Andrews asked a prisoner worker who was in a hazmat suit to attend to LaShawn as she reported, quote, "Inmate Thompson was covered in feces and lice," unquote. The reports include deeply disturbing photos that show LaShawn in death, naked on a mat on the floor in the filthy cell. A close-up shows his face crawling with insects. The Fulton County Medical Examiner wrote, quote, "The body is infested with an enormous number of small insects that are 2 millimeters in length." Michael Harper, attorney for LaShawn Thompson's family, said in a statement, "The jail cell Mr. Thompson was housed in was not fit for a diseased animal." Harper appeared on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, joined by Shanita Thompson, LaShawn's sister, and Brad McCray, his brother, in their first broadcast interview together since going public with the gruesome details of their late brother's suffering and death. Brad McCray spoke about the family's decision to share the devastating photos with the public.
I thought about Emmett Till. It broke my heart to see those photos, and we wanted the world to see it so the world can feel it and the world can wake up and see what's going on out here and get behind it and make a change. Make a change. We want the world to wake up and make a change.
Brad McCray was invoking the memory of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old African-American boy who was lynched on August 28, 1955. He was dragged out of his great-uncle's home in Money, Mississippi, where his mother had sent him from Chicago for the summer. Days later, his brutally beaten, disfigured body, weighted down with a cotton gin fan tied to his body with barbed wire, was pulled from the Tallahatchie River. Emmett's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, wanted the world to see what they'd done to her son. She insisted on an open casket funeral. Jet magazine published the picture of Emmett with his distended, brutalized head, showing the world the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry.
The jail knew that LaShawn Thompson had mental health issues in June of 2022.
That's family attorney Michael Harper on Democracy Now!
They put him in the psychiatric wing of that jail and neglected him. He was there for 3 months. There are reports in the incident report from the death that the officers, as you alluded to, were aware that he was declining. He was in a filthy cell. They complained to their superiors, and nothing happened. He was there until he died, and his body was found infested with those horrible bed bug bites and lice and insects.
Harper continued,
LaShawn Thompson was a pretrial detainee. He had not been convicted of any crime.
Last November, the Southern Center for Human Rights reported that the Fulton County Jail was dangerously understaffed and overcrowded and had an uncontained outbreak of lice and scabies. The ACLU issued a report analyzing Fulton County's jail population. The ACLU found that Fulton County regularly jails people in pretrial detention for longer than 90 days, some for over 2 years, when they haven't even been charged with a crime, and that many of those people are held simply because they can't afford bail. Fulton County responded to the public revelations of LaShawn Thompson's gruesome death by moving 600 prisoners of the jail's overcrowded population of close to 3,000. And Fulton County Sheriff Pat Labatt demanded the resignation of 3 top jail officials. County commissioners also approved $5 million for emergency improvements to the jail. Again, attorney Michael Harper.
A new jail is not going to stop neglectful detention officers from not caring for mentally ill people.
Nor will it bring back LaShawn Thompson. Brad McCray offered this hope in his brother's memory.
I want the world to remember him as a loving person, a playful person. He loved music. He loved to cook. I want the world to remember him as their cousin, their brother, their uncle, or whatever the case may be, because it could happen to their family, just like it happened to mine.
I am Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
This weekend, the Sanctuary for Independent Media is celebrating our history of working in independent media and the legacy of contributions of Steve Pierce. Radio is an important tool in this work, and Sanctuary Radio is broadcast on a lower power frequency. Wave Farm began in March of 1997 as an active group in the U.S. micro-radio movement, an activist and advisory effort that helped create the country's low-power FM radio service. We are now joined by the co-founder and artistic director of Wave Farm, Tom Rowe. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
I'm happy to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the beginnings of Wavefarm and its work on the low power frequency?
Yeah, so we began, and we were called Free 103.9 then. We were one of thousands of what we called micro radio stations, micro broadcasters, since microcasters, since we weren't broadcasting, which means to reach a large area, we were casting to a much smaller area, covering neighborhoods in New York City. We would move around locations. We would lend out the transmitter if someone was having an event, and basically try to spread community access with several FM radio transmitters in an era where the internet was just beginning.
What kind of reach did you have back then?
It depended on how tall the building we were on and how high we could get our antenna up. So basically our plan was we would set up the transmitter, do a little test, or know from previous experience that if we were on a three-story building and we were surrounded by five-story buildings, we would only get a couple blocks. But if we were on a 10-story building and the other buildings around us were three-story buildings, we would cover entire neighborhoods or several neighborhoods in Brooklyn. So there's a famous somebody... there was used to be an art residency program on top of the old World Trade Center in New York City. And an artist used a one-watt transmitter on top of the World Trade Center, and they could get their signal heard at 23rd Street. So it's much more about how high you are than the power of your transmitter.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a micro radio station and a low-power radio station?
It's basically the same thing. The terminology evolved. Part of what the civil disobedience that we were doing and thousands of stations across the country were doing was because there was no the Federal Communications Commission did not have a way for you to apply to do a low power station. At that point, you could not apply to do a station of 100 watts or lower. And there was clearly space on the dial for stations 100 watts or lower in many, many communities across the country. The various microcasters prove that by going on the air and not interrupting other programming. So basically, we were one facet in a several facet, I don't know if it was a plan, but it was an effort to get low power FM legalized. There were court cases going on. The Free Radio Berkeley famously was allowed to broadcast as a pirate station for 18 months because of a court in San Francisco. There was all kinds of pro-media coverage that showed these people doing these pirate radio stations, and they were doing things like the commercial station would stop broadcasting the town council meeting, and the pirate radio station would step in and broadcast the town council meeting. There was a famous case in Texas. A station called Kind Radio was in between San Antonio and Austin, and the licensed station to it, that community did not broadcast any information about what was going on in that community. And so there was a giant flood in that community, and the mayor had to go on the pirate radio station to get important information out to the community because the commercial station licensed to the community was busy selling ads to San Antonio and Austin instead of serving its local community.
Thomas, co-founder of Wave Farms, can you tell us about its beginnings and your journey?
Yeah, so we started as Free 103.9 in 1997 in New York City, mostly in the Williamsburg neighborhood. And we eventually started doing more and more projects throughout the city. And we started doing more and more projects with artists. And we saw that there were thousands of these stations across the country, each doing their own thing, each having a different personality. And we saw not any of them were really focused on making the content on their station artistic or special or different. And so that is sort of where we focused our efforts. And we started working with artists that worked with radio as their medium. And we eventually became a full-fledged nonprofit organization first called Freeway 103.9 still, and then we moved upstate and started a residency program and got a property that we called Wave Farm and changed the organization's name to Wave Farm. And now we have a residency program with people from around the world coming every year to work on different radio projects. We have a radio art park with different installations on the property outdoors that all involve radio waves in some way. We have a library and a full power FM station. We're not allowed to have a low power FM station because when they passed the law allowing low power FM stations, they passed it twice, thanks largely in part to Republican John McCain and Obama getting rid of the Democrat on the Commerce Committee who was blocking it. Once it was passed, they put in a rule that if you were a former pirate, you couldn't get a low power station. But there's no law against a former pirate getting a full power station. Actually, when we moved up here, we found that the few commercial stations that remained up here in this area with actual people, human beings running the stations, they all had people with a background in pirate radio running the station. So it's widespread throughout the industry that people begin in pirate radio and then become part of other stations.
So how does the U.S. micro radio movement connect to the independent media movement?
Yeah, we grew out of the independent media center kind of movement. It was the sort of pre-internet or the just starting of the internet days. And so the mainstream media was not covering issues, I say, on the far left or the far right at all at that point. You know, the internet sort of changed all that. But we were aligned with that independent media center movement to basically allow more people to have a say in their media. We align it today as we think the public airwaves belong to the public and should have public access.
Yeah.
And so our station in Greene and Columbia County, it also covers much of Southern Albany and Southern Rensselaer County. We try to get as make as much access to the airwaves as possible, whether people that means people doing their own shows, people doing their own segments like on your show, having open phone lines as much as possible so people can call in during shows, and having a pretty much open door policy. If somebody needs to be a guest on a show, we'll try whatever we can to make that happen.
What are you discovering through your project of transmission arts?
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, that's the broader term for radio art that we use. And we use transmission art because we are talking about any sort of transmission on the radio dial. The definition of radio includes television, it includes baby monitors, it includes shortwave radio, CB radio. And so we work with artists that work in all of these mediums or sometimes several of them together. So transmission arts is meant to be a larger phrase to be very inclusive of all sorts of different kinds of radio.
With 1 minute left to go, is there anything you'd like to add, and where can people find more information?
Well, the big news at Wave Farm this summer is that beginning in June, we're going to have open hours for the Wave Farm Art Park on and campus. You don't need to make you need to make a reservation online, but you don't need to make an appointment, a special appointment. We have special appointment days throughout the rest of much of the year, not during the winter. But you can come see Zach Poff's Pond Station in person. You can come see Yvette Janine Jackson's amazing exhibit in the woods at Wave Farm, and you can tour the property, see the radio station, see the library, and see all kinds of different art projects.
Thank you, Tom, for joining us for this segment. Thank you for sharing the history and providing our listeners to the history of how we are here today, and thank you for your leadership.
All right, you can go to wavefarm.org for more information. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Tom Rowe of Wave Farm. Learn more about Wave Farm at wavefarm.org. At this weekend's event, we will be celebrating independent media and radio with guest Amy Goodman of Democracy Now, Saturday, April 22nd. Tickets are available at mediasanctuary.org.
The folks at the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement recorded the rallies for immigrants and bills in the state budget for immigrants at the state capitol on Monday, April 17th. WOOC put together this collage of their recordings from the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement of this rally at the capitol April 17th.
Legal protection and asylum.